Good morning and welcome to Flight Logic Brief. It's Friday, June 12th, 2026. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. We've got a good one today, Alex. Business jet news is absolutely popping.
It really is. We've got a milestone out of Savannah that's kind of a two-for-one, a big Asia-Pacific build-out story, an acquisition that's going to get the brokerage world talking, and then later on, some fascinating stuff out of the airline world, too. American Airlines shopping for new widebodies, the 747 down to its last four passenger operators.
And a guy who allegedly flew as a captain for 17 years without the license he was supposed to have. We have to talk about that one.
Oh, we're getting there. Buckle up. But let's start where the industry's attention is this morning, which is Gulfstream. So this dropped on June 10th. Gulfstream Aerospace announced they have completed the 100th customer delivery of the G700. That's their ultra-long-range flagship. And on the same day, the same aircraft program logged its 100th city pair speed record.
On the same day. That's the part that gets me. Both hundreds landing together.
Right. It's a nice round bit of symmetry. And they actually had a 101st delivery teed up right behind it.
Okay, but let's separate those two numbers because they're telling you two different things. The 100 deliveries, that's the demand story. That's saying the ultra-long range market is still hungry, even after everybody was predicting a cool down. 100 of those airframes out the door and into customer hands, that's real money. That's real backlog burn down.
And these are not cheap airplanes.
These are not cheap airplanes. We're talking up near the top of the business jet food chain. But the speed records, Alex, that's the operational story. And honestly, for our listeners, that's the more interesting one. 100 city pair records means operators are actually flying this thing hard on long international legs, and the performance is holding up in the real world, not just on a spec sheet.
That's a good distinction, because a city pair record isn't a closed course thing. That's a real flight, real payload, real winds.
Exactly. One of the ones they highlighted was Savannah out to San Jose. And when you're a flight department evaluating this aircraft for, say, a trans-Pacific mission profile, those documented city pairs are data points you actually use. You're sitting there going, okay, can it make my mission with my payload, with reserves, on a bad wind day? 100 records gives you a library to plan against.
So it's marketing. But it's marketing that doubles as planning data.
That's the smartest kind. And look, it puts pressure on everybody else at the top of the market. If you're cross-shopping ultra-long range, Gulfstream's basically saying, here's 100 proof points, what have you got?
Now here's what's interesting. That Gulfstream story dovetails directly into the other big theme today, which is everybody planting flags in Asia-Pacific. And Bombardier's making a huge move at Singapore.
Huge. Tell me the numbers.
So Bombardier is going to nearly double its Singapore service center at Seletar Airport. They're adding a 250,000-square-foot facility. Hangars, enhanced operational support, and, this is the part I want your take on, recompletion capability.
Okay, recompletion is the tell. That's not just a maintenance, repair, and overhaul play. Anybody can bolt on a hangar and call it an MRO. Recompletion means cabin refurbishment, interior reconfiguration, the high-value, high-margin work. That tells me Bombardier sees a maturing in-service fleet in the region that's going to start cycling through mid-life interior refreshes.
And you only build that if you think the airplanes are going to be there for the long haul.
Right. You don't make that kind of capital commitment at Seletar speculatively. This is one of the bigger Asia-Pacific infrastructure investments the Canadians have made in years. And the timing is not a coincidence because, and I know we're getting to this, the fleet's growing out there right now.
You're reading my run sheet. Let's go to Corporate Jet Investor because they've got the rest of this picture. So Corporate Jet Investor's reporting that Metrojet, that's the Hong Kong-based management and charter outfit, has added a Bombardier Global 8000 to its managed fleet. And the headline here is it's the first Global 8000 based anywhere in Asia.
First in Asia. There's your reason for the Seletar expansion right there. The Global 8000, that's the 8000 nautical mile near Mach 0.9 airplane, room for up to 19 passengers. You put the first one of those in the region, and you'd better have the support footprint to keep it flying.
And it's not just Bombardier setting up shop. Gulfstream also opened its first dedicated customer support office in Singapore.
Of course they did. Where?
Co-located at Jet Aviation's facility over at Changi. 8 professionals, technical management, materials, quality, field service, regional support.
8 people doesn't sound like a lot until you realize what those 8 people do. That's a forward-deployed brain trust. When an operator in the region has an airplane-on-ground situation, having materials and field service people in the same time zone is the difference between a few hours and a few days. For a flight department, support proximity is becoming a real factor in the buy decision. You're not just buying the airplane, you're buying how fast somebody can get you flying again when something breaks at 3 a.m. in Singapore.
So both of the big ultra-long-range manufacturers planting support flags within, what, miles of each other?
Same hub, basically. It's an arms race, and it's an arms race in the customer's favor for once. More support, more competition for your service dollar.
Okay, now the one that's going to get shared around the most today. Corporate jet investors calling it an exclusive. Flexjet has acquired the jet business.
Oh, Varsano.
Steve Varsano, founder of the jet business, the London-based brokerage. And as part of this, Varsano becomes president of Flexjet.
This is fascinating, and here's why. Steve Varsano is arguably the most famous aircraft broker on the planet. The man has 2.5 million followers on TikTok. He's got that showroom in London with the full-size fuselage mock-up.
The one everybody's seen the videos of.
Everybody's seen it. So what Flexjet is buying is not just a brokerage book of business. They're buying a brand and a face. They're buying reach. Think about it. Fractional and charter is a relationship business, and Varsano is a relationship machine with a media following most flight departments couldn't dream of.
So you see this as consolidation with a marketing engine attached?
Both. The sector's been consolidating for a while. The independent advisory shops getting folded into the big charter and fractional platforms. But most of those deals are quiet. This one is loud on purpose. Putting Varsano in the president's chair, that's a statement. I'd be a little curious how the rest of the independent brokerage world feels about one of their most visible guys going in-house at a fractional operator.
That's a good question. Does it ruffle feathers?
It might. When the world's best-known independent advisor is suddenly not independent, every other broker has to answer the question of whose side am I really on? But commercially, for Flexjet, smart. Very smart.
Couple more out of corporate jet investor, a little more bread and butter. Aerodienst, the German operator, subsidiary of the motorist club ADAC, has ordered a second Bombardier Challenger 650 for its medevac fleet.
And this one actually shows up twice in our stack today. Aviation International News reported the same partnership expansion. Air ambulance is a serious, serious mission. That airplane's getting configured with advanced intensive care capability in the cabin. The 650 is a great platform for it. Big cabin, great range, proven systems. The fact that they're going back for a second one tells you the first one's earning its keep.
Reliability matters a lot when there's a patient in the back.
It's everything. Dispatch reliability on a medevac airplane is not a luxury. It's the whole value proposition. So a repeat order is a quiet but strong vote of confidence in the type.
Then there's Hapajet, Fort Lauderdale operator, and they've added a Cessna Citation X to their managed fleet.
Now this one's interesting because Hapajet has historically been a Bombardier shop. That's been their identity. So bringing in a Citation X, the super midsize, Mach 0.9, 51,000-foot airplane, that's a diversification move.
Why diversify?
Couple reasons. Could be a specific customer brought the airplane to them and they're managing it. But strategically broadening your managed fleet types lets you serve missions you couldn't before. The Citation X is fast. It's one of the fastest civilian airplanes you can buy. So if you've got a client who values speed on the shorter transcon legs, now you've got an answer for them. The flip side is added complexity. Different parts, different training, different maintenance relationships.
So there's a cost to spreading out.
There's always a cost. But for a growing operator, a little fleet diversity can open doors. And last one here, just a quick people note. Westar Aviation promoted Jeff Messmer to manager of technical sales at their Perryville, Missouri facility. Nearly 15 years at the company, decades of maintenance experience, started out as an Army guy.
Love seeing the maintenance floor to sales path.
That's the best kind of technical salesperson, honestly. The one who actually turned the wrenches. When a guy like that tells you what your airplane needs, you believe him because he's been under it.
Well said. Let's shift gears a little. There's a story over on Business Jet Interiors, came through Google News. That's a glimpse of where the cabin experience is heading. Cirrus Aircraft has launched an Apple Vision Pro Flight Experience app.
Wait, the headset? The spatial computing headset?
The headset. It's an immersive flight experience app built for Apple's Vision Pro. And what stood out to me is that this is one of the first moves by a major general aviation manufacturer into Apple's spatial computing space.
Okay, so I want to be careful here because it would be easy to roll your eyes at this. But think about what Cirrus is really doing. This is a sales tool. This is a marketing and demonstration tool. You put a prospective buyer in the headset, and you can walk them through the airplane, the experience, without an airplane physically in front of them.
So it's the showroom in your living room.
It's the showroom anywhere. And for a company like Cirrus, whose whole brand is making aviation feel accessible and modern, leaning into Apple's ecosystem is completely on brand. Now, is it going to change how anybody flies? No. But as a way to reach the next generation of owner pilots, I think it's clever. Get somebody in that headset and they're picturing themselves in the left seat.
And it plants a flag. Cirrus being first matters for the brand.
Being first is half the story. The headline writes itself, and here we are talking about it.
Here we are. All right, let's get a little more cerebral. Bjorn Ferm over at Liam News has a new entry in his aircraft structure series, and this one's right in our wheelhouse. So the piece is the latest in his structure series, and it's all about two competing design philosophies. Safe life versus fail safe.
Oh, this is foundational stuff. And the history is genuinely sobering. This whole framework comes out of the early jet age, out of pressurized fuselages and the catastrophic fatigue failures that taught the industry these lessons the hard way.
The de Havilland comet, basically.
That's the ghost hanging over all of this, yeah. So let me give the quick version. Material fatigue became the critical factor in structural design once you started pressurizing and depressurizing a cabin thousands of times. Metal doesn't like being cycled like that forever. So designers picked specific aluminum alloys based on their fatigue characteristics, and then they had to decide on a philosophy.
And the two philosophies are?
Safe Life says, this component will be retired at a fixed number of cycles or hours, full stop, before it's statistically likely to develop a crack. You don't wait for a problem, you just pull it and replace it on schedule. Failsafe says, design the structure so that if one element does fail, the load redistributes, the rest of the structure carries it, and the airplane keeps flying long enough for somebody to find that crack at the next inspection.
So one is replace before it can fail, the other is build it so a failure isn't catastrophic.
Exactly, and modern airplanes use a blend, plus damage tolerance on top. And here's why our listeners should care, even the corporate jet folks. This is the why behind your life-limited parts and your structural inspection intervals. When your maintenance program tells you a component comes off at a certain number of cycles regardless of how good it looks, that's Safe Life philosophy reaching out and touching your airplane.
That reframes the whole airworthiness directive conversation, honestly.
It does. Those aren't arbitrary numbers. There's 70 years of hard-won engineering behind every one of them.
Bjorn also has a separate series running, Airbus's next new airplane. And the latest installment is a SWOT analysis of Airbus's competitive position. Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats.
And the headline finding is kind of counterintuitive, right?
It is. The piece argues that Airbus is actually in a position of structural market advantage over Boeing right now. Boeing's clawed its way back from the 737 MAX groundings, from COVID, from the production quality problems. But Airbus has its own pressures, supply chain being a big one.
And that's the thing people miss. Everyone's been so focused on Boeing's very public struggles that there's an assumption Airbus is just cruising. They're not. They've got supply chain constraints. They've got their own production ramp challenges. Being ahead doesn't mean being comfortable. A SWOT analysis is a useful gut check on that. It forces you to look at the threats even when you're winning.
And for our pilots, the duopoly's health affects everybody. Delivery slots, fleet planning, the airplanes you'll be flying in 10 years.
Which, perfect segue, is exactly the kind of decision American Airlines is wrestling with right now. Can we jump over to simple flying?
We can, let's do it. So American Airlines is in talks with both Airbus and Boeing over a replacement for its aging 777-200ERs. CEO Robert Isom confirmed at the June 10th shareholder meeting they've issued requests for proposals to both manufacturers.
How many airframes are we talking?
47 of them. The 777-200ERs are pushing 25 years old, retirement penciled in for the 2030s.
47 wide bodies is an enormous order. That's a campaign both Boeing and Airbus will fight tooth and nail for. And the candidates basically pick themselves. You're looking at the 777X, the 787, or on the Airbus side, the A350. 47 frames worth of wide body backlog is the kind of thing that moves a manufacturer's whole decade.
And it ties right back to the Liam SWOT conversation.
It absolutely does. This is the duopoly battle playing out in real time with a marquee customer. Whoever wins American's wide-body replacement gets a halo. And the timeline matters. They're talking retirement in the 2030s, so the decision and the delivery slots get negotiated now. This is a multi-year, multi-billion-dollar chess move.
Speaking of milestones for these manufacturers, Airbus just announced the A320 family has surpassed 20,000 cumulative orders.
20,000. Let that sink in. 20,000 orders for a single aircraft family. That is the best-selling commercial aircraft family in history, full stop. It cements Airbus's dominance in the narrow-body market, and the narrow-body market is the bread and butter. That's the volume game. That's where the real money lives.
Meanwhile, Boeing had a bit of a mixed month. Deliveries up 33% in May. 60 aircraft, 51 of them 737 MAX. Strongest monthly output since production resumed back in late 2024.
That's genuinely good news for Boeing. 60 airplanes, that's a recovery number. The delivery line is the lifeblood. That's when Boeing actually gets paid.
But orders dipped to just 11 in May, after an airline walked back a commitment.
And that's the asterisk. Deliveries up, orders down, a customer backing out. It tells you the recovery's real, but it's still fragile. You want to see both lines climbing, the deliveries and the order intake. One good month on deliveries is encouraging. I'd want to see it sustained before I called it a trend.
Now here's one that's a little bittersweet for the four engine fans. Only four airlines still fly passenger 747s.
Four. Name them.
Lufthansa, Air China, Korean Air, and Rossiya. And the article gets into what a premium class ticket on the Queen of the Skies actually costs these days.
It's the end of an era, and the reason is pure economics. The twin jets, your 707s, your 787s, your A350s, they replicated what the 747 could do with two engines instead of four. Two engines to maintain instead of four, two engines worth of fuel instead of four. The math just doesn't favor the four-holer anymore.
But people still seek it out.
They do. There's a romance to it. The upper deck, the nose, the whole experience. So if you want to fly the 747 as a passenger, the window's closing, and these four carriers are basically the last call. As a professional, I get the economics completely. As an aviation lover, yeah, it stings a little.
On the size theme, there's a fun comparison piece. How much wider is the A380 versus the upcoming 77X?
Oh, I love a good cabin width nerd out.
The A380's main deck has an internal cabin width of 21 feet 4 inches. The 707X will have 19 feet 7 inches of usable width on its single deck.
So the A380 is still the champ. Widest single passenger cabin ever to enter service, nearly 2 feet wider than the 707X. But here's the nuance, and it matters for the airlines. The 707X is a single-deck airplane, and a lot of operators actually prefer that. Single deck means simpler boarding, simpler servicing, simpler everything on the ground. The A380's width is spectacular, but you're paying for it with two decks of operational complexity. Width isn't the only number that matters.
And turn times are money.
Turn times are everything. A gorgeous wide cabin doesn't help you if the airplane's sitting at the gate too long.
Couple more from Simple Flying. EVE Air, the carrier that actually invented premium economy back in 1992, has reclaimed the title for the most spacious version of it.
Wait, EVE invented premium economy?
Back in 92, yeah. And in 2025, they introduced a fourth generation product on the 787-9 with an industry-leading 42-inch seat pitch.
42 inches in premium economy is genuinely a lot of legroom, and it's a smart competitive position. Premium economy has become the cabin where airlines actually make really good margins. It's the sweet spot between economy and business. So for EVE to plant the flag and say, we invented this and we still do it best, that's a strong brand message in a cabin class everyone's now fighting over.
Then there's a quick maintenance and operations story. Iberia's Airbus A350-900 is back in service after a winglet got damaged. And Sam, you'll love how it got damaged.
How?
A ceremonial water cannon salute. June 4th, at Guayaquil, Ecuador. During the salute, the aircraft's left winglet got damaged, and it's been out of service until a new winglet arrived. Back flying as of today, June 12th.
Okay, the water cannon itself didn't damage the winglet. To be clear, something in that ground sequence did, but the operational lesson here is real. One winglet, and you've got an airplane on the ground for over a week waiting on a part. That's the brutal reality of wide-body parts logistics. A single composite control or aerodynamic surface and your multi-hundred-million-dollar airplane is a very expensive lawn ornament until the part shows up.
Parts availability strikes again.
It's always parts. Ask anybody who runs a fleet. The airplane's never the problem. It's getting the one piece you need to where the airplane is.
Let's do a couple from the military and growth side quickly. Porter Airlines smashed 10 million seats in 2026. 10.34 million scheduled. First time over 10 million, roughly 8 times its capacity from less than 2 decades ago.
Porter's growth story is wild. Eightfold in under 20 years. That's a regional darling turning into a serious national player. When you scale capacity like that, you're making enormous fleet and infrastructure bets. And so far, the bets are paying off.
And two military quickies. The Navy and why the F/A-18 flies those extreme nose-high angles of attack on carrier approach. About 8 degrees on a 3.5-degree glide slope.
And that's not a flaw, that's by design. High angle of attack gets you the lift you need at low approach speed, gets the hook hanging down to catch the wire, and gives the pilot the visibility over the nose to fly the ball. It looks dramatic, but every bit of it is intentional. Carrier aviation is just a different world.
And the B-52, there's a piece on why it's more lethal in 2026 than when it was built. $48.6 billion modernization into the B-52J variant. Glass cockpit, AESA radar, Link 16 data sharing, new Rolls-Royce engines.
The airplane first flew in 1952, and it's going to serve into the 2050s. 100 years of service for one airframe design. Re-engine it, give it a digital brain, modern radar, and the basic airframe is so sound it just keeps going. There's no better argument for good fundamental engineering than the B-52.
Designed by people who are long gone, flown by pilots whose grandparents weren't born yet.
It's incredible. All right, where to next?
Let's go to the air current, because there's a really interesting electric vertical takeoff story out of Germany. So Germany's electric vertical takeoff and landing sector, the eVTOL world, took some big hits in 2024. Lilium and Volocopter both ran out of money.
Right. Those were two of the marquee European names. And when they ran out of capital, the momentum in the whole sector shifted toward the US and China.
But the reporting is that Germany's now giving eVTOL another look, and there's a new wrinkle. A company called ERC has unveiled a heavy-lift cargo drone.
And the cargo angle is the smart pivot, honestly. The passenger-carrying eVTOL dream ran into a wall of certification difficulty and a wall of money. Carrying people is the hardest possible version of this. The certification bar is sky-high and rightly so. But heavy-lift cargo? Different risk calculus. No passengers. More tolerance, clearer near-term business case, logistics, industrial lift, that kind of thing.
So you think cargo's the path that actually survives?
I think cargo is where this technology proves itself and makes money first, and then the passenger applications follow once the tech and the regulations mature. Germany losing Lilium and Volocopter was a gut punch for European aerospace pride. The fact that they're taking another look, but through a more pragmatic cargo lens, that's a healthier approach. Walk before you run.
All right, let's get into the community. Over on Reddit's r/flying, there's a serious safety thread we should not skip past. So a pilot operating under instrument flight rules, IFR, posted about a genuinely scary encounter. Being vectored near Colorado Springs, heading toward Colorado's Front Range at 9,000 feet, and they get circled by a flight of two, a formation of two visual flight rules aircraft.
A formation of two VFR airplanes circling an IFR aircraft under vectors. That's a near midair full stop.
And the kicker, one of the airplanes, a yellow and white one, had minimal ADS-B presence, barely showing up.
Okay, this hits several hot buttons at once. First, uncoordinated VFR formation flying in busy terminal airspace is playing with fire. Formation flight requires briefing, discipline, and ideally a plan that keeps you clear of the IFR flow. Second, the weak ADS-B return, automatic dependent surveillance broadcast, means air traffic control may not have had a clean picture to warn the IFR pilot, and the traffic alert systems may not have given a clean alert either.
And when your head's down on the gauges in the system,
you're trusting the system and you're trusting see and avoid as a backstop. Both of those got stressed here. The big takeaway for our listeners, even in controlled airspace, even on an IFR clearance, see and avoid is still your job in visual conditions. keep your scan going. And if you fly formation, the responsibility to stay clear of everybody else is enormous. This one could have been a tragedy, and it sounds like it was close.
Sobering. Let's lighten it up, though, because there's a fun slash cautionary one. A guy posted, quote, I got a free 414, now what?
A free 414, a Cessna 414, the twin.
Inherited a 1970 Cessna 414 from his grandfather. 1,200 hours total time, perfect logs, kept out of the weather, but it's been grounded for 8 years.
Oh, and this is the great lesson of aviation. There is no such thing as a free airplane.
I had a feeling you'd say that.
8 years of dormancy on a piston twin is the scary part. Beautiful logs, low time, that's all wonderful. But airplanes do not like sitting. You're looking at potential corrosion, seals dried out, engines that have been static for 8 years. And on a 414, you've got two of them. There are calendar-based inspection items that don't care how few hours are on the airframe. Before that airplane flies, it needs a deep, deep annual inspection by somebody who knows the type cold.
So the gift comes with a bill.
The gift is the cheap part. Returning a long-dormant cabin-class twin to airworthiness can run into serious money. Engines alone could be the price of a nice car or two. It can absolutely be worth it. It's a lovely airplane, but go in with eyes open and a thorough pre-return inspection. Don't let sentiment write the checks.
There's a related one. A commercially rated pilot floated a flying club business plan. 4 or 5 wealthy members, $40,000 to $60,000 buy-in, $3,000 to $5,000 a month in dues, $400 a flight hour, to share access to a luxury airplane like a Diamond DA-62.
And apparently the business plan was ChatGPT assisted, which, no shade, but the fundamentals here are where it gets tricky, and our professional listeners will smell it immediately. The moment you're collecting money and providing transportation, you have to ask, is this a private club genuinely sharing costs, or have you accidentally built an illegal charter operation?
The line between cost sharing and commercial operation.
That's the whole ballgame. There's a real regulatory distinction between members of a bona fide flying club sharing the actual costs of operating an airplane they collectively own versus a structure that's effectively selling transportation by the hour. If it walks and talks like charter, the Federal Aviation Administration is going to treat it like charter, and that means you need the appropriate operating certificate. These models can work, but you need an aviation attorney before ChatGPT.
That's a great pairing, actually. There were a couple of pro rata cost-sharing questions in the threads, too.
There always are, and they're worth a reminder. Under the private pilot cost-sharing rules, you can only share a narrow, specific list of operating expenses with your passengers. Fuel, oil, airport fees, rental, and you have to pay your pro rata share. You can't have a passenger cover, say, a rental car and call it square. The list is intentionally narrow. When in doubt, assume the rule is stricter than you'd like.
Couple of career ones in there, too. There's a thread from a Canadian 787 pilot in Tokyo about expat opportunities for pilots with 1,000-plus jet hours.
And that's a genuinely underrated pathway. Airlines in Asia, the Middle East, Africa, South America actively hire foreign pilots, sometimes with hour requirements that are very reachable for a regional or low-cost carrier first officer back home. If you've got jet time and a type rating and you're flexible about geography, there's a whole global market a lot of North American pilots never seriously consider. The pay and the lifestyle vary enormously. Do your homework. But the door's more open than people think.
And there's the perennial airline pilots who struggled through flight school and instructing, when did you finally feel not poor?
That thread breaks my heart and gives me hope at the same time. The traditional U.S. pipeline buries people in debt and pays them next to nothing during the instructing years. The good news in 2026 is the back half of that career pays well enough that the people answering are saying it does eventually flip. But we shouldn't gloss over how brutal the front end still is. It's the single biggest barrier to the profession.
And one that's pure fun to close out the community section. SpaceX bought a helicopter.
Of course they did. What did they buy?
A 2013 Bell 429, registration November 429er X-ray X-ray, delivered May 13th, estimated $4 to $5 million. For rocket launch operations.
The Bell 429's a great light twin. Twin turbine, smooth, capable. Makes total sense for launch support. You've got range safety, you've got crew and personnel movement around big coastal launch sites, you've got rapid response. A twin engine helicopter over water and around launch infrastructure is exactly the right tool. Honestly, A little surprising they didn't already have a fleet of them.
The space company needed an aircraft. Full circle.
It always comes back to airplanes and helicopters.
All right, let's bring it home with a few from the video desk. YouTube, and we're going to start with the one you've been dying to talk about all show.
Finally, the 17 years.
Okay, so a Canadian pilot, named in the reporting as Joff Wall, a former Air Canada captain, has been charged with operating as an airline captain for approximately 17 years without holding a valid air transport pilot license. The ATPL. The credential you are required to have to sit in that seat.
17 years. Over 900 flights, the reporting says. Domestic and international in 767s, 777s, 787s.
Wide bodies. As captain.
Okay, I have so many questions, and the most important one for our listeners is, how? How does a system designed with so many checks let someone operate at the command level of a major airline for 17 years without the top-tier license? Because the implication isn't just about one individual, it's about the verification process.
That's where my head went too. This is an oversight question as much as an individual one.
Completely. Now, the charge is fraud, and we should be fair. Charged is not convicted, and the reporting suggests the man may well have had the skills and lower-level licensing and recurrent training along the way. This may be a credentialing and documentation issue rather than some guy who never learned to fly. But even framed that way, it's a massive institutional embarrassment. Your ATPL is the non-negotiable baseline for command of a transport aircraft. If the system can't reliably verify that, that's a finding that should make every airline check its own paperwork.
And the flying public never knew.
And presumably flew perfectly safely the whole time, which is its own strange twist. But safety and compliance aren't the same thing. You can have one without the other, and the regulatory framework requires both. I genuinely want to see how this one shakes out, because the lessons are going to be about process integrity.
We'll keep an eye on it. Sobering pivot, though, there's a fatal accident in the reporting we should cover responsibly. A private jet crashed during an emergency landing in the Dominican Republic.
What do we know?
Details are still early, so we're careful here. The aircraft was on a repositioning flight, Dominican Republic, bound for Austin, Texas. Mechanical issues shortly after takeoff, the crew attempted to return to the departure airport, and the aircraft crashed and was consumed by fire on the emergency return. Both pilots aboard were fatally injured. No passengers. It was a repositioning leg.
First, condolences. Two fellow aviators lost, and the scenario, mechanical problem shortly after takeoff, turn back to the field, is one of the most demanding situations in all of flying. You're low, you're heavy, you're slow, you've got limited altitude and limited time, and you're trying to diagnose and fly simultaneously. It's the classic high workload, low margin emergency.
And we won't speculate on cause.
We won't, and we shouldn't. The investigators will do their work, and the lessons will come out in time. What I'll say generally is that the return to field decision after a takeoff malfunction is exactly why we brief it on every single departure. Know your options before you push the throttles up, because you will not have time to invent a plan at 400 feet with something failing. That's the discipline this tragic reminder reinforces.
Well said. Let's end on something lighter, because that's a heavy note and our audience knows the risks. Red Bull's got a new airshow act in training.
Oh, good. Tell me it's insane.
It's pretty insane. Luke Akins, skydiver and pilot on the Red Bull team, is training a new opening act where they lift a clipped-in person out of a vehicle using an airplane flying at around 1,100 feet and then release them to parachute down.
So they're plucking a human out of a moving vehicle with an airplane.
With an airplane, at about 1,100 feet.
The precision required for that is just staggering. The energy management, the formation flying down low, the timing of the pickup and the release, this is the absolute pointy end of demonstration flying. These folks practice relentlessly, with deep safety planning behind the spectacle. It looks like daredevil chaos, and it's actually meticulous engineering and rehearsal.
The showmanship hides the discipline.
That's the theme of the entire show today, isn't it? Whether it's a B-52 flying for a century or 100 speed records or a Red Bull stunt, behind every bit of it is the boring, beautiful, relentless discipline. That's aviation.
Couldn't have set that up better myself. All right, that's our brief for Friday, June 12th. Quick recap of the headlines. Gulfstream's G700 hits its 100th delivery and 100th speed record on the same day. Both Bombardier and Gulfstream are building out support in Singapore. Flexjet buys the jet business and makes Steve Varsano president. American Airlines goes shopping for 47 new widebodies, and a Canadian captain's 17 years in the cockpit are now a courtroom question.
And remember the through line, folks. There's no such thing as a free 414. See and avoid is always your job. And if your business plan came from a chatbot, call a lawyer before you call your members.
Words to fly by. Thanks for spending your morning with us. Check your notices to air missions, brief your departure, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Fly safe, everybody. Blue skies.
This has been Flight Logic Brief. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. Take care.